politics is never completely black or white. It's about helping processes to develop the right direction.
Bangladesh and Myanmar talk about repatriating Rohingya refugees. It's Monday, November 20th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, India's turbulent state of gay rights. A new Aboriginal museum opens. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Bangladesh is in negotiations with Myanmar aimed at a deal to repatriate Rohingya refugees. VOA Asia's Ira Melman reports the Bangladeshi foreign minister is traveling to its neighbor.
A statement attributed to Abul Hassan Mahmoud Ali said Bangladesh and Myanmar are in the process of negotiation for a bilateral agreement for repatriation of displaced people and expect to form a joint working group to facilitate the repatriation. Last week, a United Nations General Assembly committee called on Myanmar to end military operations that have led to the systemic violation and abuse of human rights of Rohingya Muslims, said the statement. The move revived a UN resolution that was dropped last year due to Myanmar's progress on human rights. The announcement of the communication between Bangladesh and Myanmar came the same day EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini and other foreign ministers visited Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh. Mogherini expressed her feeling that the negotiating table is the place to reach an agreement to end the situation.
Our approach has always been and will continue to be to offer a negotiating space, encourage the taking care of this situation that is not going to disappear. So it is, I think, a responsibility of the authorities to find solutions. And again, the international community has indicated some of the solutions, especially the Kofi Annan plan that San Suu Kyi has committed to implement. And we are there to support her in doing this.
After touring the Katupalang refugee camp and speaking to Rohingya women there, Mogherini also called for understanding of Aung San Suu Kyi's young democratic government.
You can ask different people around the world if they trust their leadership. The point is that we have to deal with what is there. And I would also have to add that, yes, there is a responsibility of the current leadership. There is also the difficult situation of a young democracy that just a few years ago entered a complicated process itself. And I believe that we have to understand the complexity of this situation. And again, life and politics is never completely black or white. It's about helping processes to develop the right direction.
As for the attitude of many of those in the Bangladesh refugee camp, Swedish Foreign Minister Margot Wallström, another member of the EU delegation, said that many had expressed a demand to Mogherini.
Federica also asked them, what do you want? Do you want to return? And they said, yes, we want to return, but with statehoodship and with also safety, knowing that we can feel secure.
Rohingyas have been denied citizenship in Myanmar, where many Buddhists regard them as illegal immigrants from Bangladesh. Top UN officials have denounced the violence as a classic case of ethnic cleansing. The Myanmar government has denied those allegations. Ira Melman, VOA Asia, Washington.
These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Top China diplomat talks refugee crisis with Myanmar leaders. U.S. pulls Cambodia's election funding, Hun Sen says, cut it all. Defector's condition indicates serious health issues in North Korea. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, when you have a chance, stop by our voanews.com website. The Indian LGBT community's battle to scrap a colonial-era law that criminalizes gay sex has taken a tortuous route. Scrapped in 2009, it was reinstated by 2013 by the Supreme Court, dealing a massive blow to gay rights. But as Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, there is renewed optimism that a recent Supreme Court ruling has paved the way to overturn the law, which the top court is due to review.
The beat of drums was louder, the chanting and dancing more exuberant as the gay community marched at the annual Queer Pride Parade in the Indian capital this week. The reason? A recent landmark judgment by the Supreme Court, which declared privacy is a fundamental right that must protect, among other things, sexual orientation. Anjali Gopalan, founder of NAS Foundation, which is at the forefront of the legal battle for gay rights, says the judgment will have an important bearing when the Supreme Court reviews the archaic law called Section 377.
5 out of the 9 judges, because that was a 9-judge bench, actually questioned the validity of 377. So to me, that's amazing. I feel a little easier after the privacy judgment.
Manak Martiani was heartened on hearing the top court say that some matters are not the business of the government.
And in this case, where it is consensual, where it is something that you are not doing to harm anybody else, it is a private matter and that you have the right to decide who you are, how you will live your life. That made us very hopeful.
There is opposition to gay rights from some Hindu, Muslim and Christian religious groups on the grounds of public morality. They say Indian society frowns upon homosexuality but have not reacted yet to the court ruling. The 156-year-old law, which makes gay sex punishable with up to 10 years in prison, is seldom enforced, and many belonging to the well-off sections like Martiani live openly as gays. But it exposes those less privileged to harassment. Pobir Hazara has found acceptance at the NAS Foundation where he works as a cook, but that is not the case in public spaces.
When I meet friends in a park on a holiday to relax, to have a drink, the police waves us away. They say you will create a nuisance and threaten to detain us if we don't leave.
Gopalan says the lack of rights has a range of serious implications for the community.
If someone from the LGBT community, for example, is raped, it's really difficult for them to go and register a case because Section 377 is in place, because they are not seen as part of society, right? So therefore, if we have a law which protects them, at least they have that recourse.
That is why Martiani says the parade was more than a celebration of gay pride.
It's important to remember that the march is still a protest. It is still, out there to say that, rights are not given to people.
That is what participants are hoping to get. Legal protection for their sexual orientation, a right now taken for granted in most democratic countries. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. For the first time, a museum in Australia is telling the stories of the massacres by colonists of Indigenous people from an Aboriginal perspective. It is thought thousands of First Nation people were murdered by white settlers up until the 1940s, but much of that history is yet to be uncovered. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Near the city of Portland is the site of the oldest known massacre of Indigenous people in the Australian state of Victoria. There was tension in the early 1830s between European settlers who'd set up a whaling station and a local Aboriginal tribe over a whale carcass. The precise details of the confrontation have been hard to establish, but between 60 to 200 First Nation people were murdered in what's known as the Convincing Ground Massacre. The killings are part of a series of stories being told in a new exhibition at the Melbourne Museum. Called Black Day, Sun Rises, Blood Runs, the multimedia show is included in the museum's Bundjilica Aboriginal Cultural Centre. The stories are told by Indigenous people who've been filmed at the sites of several massacres. Officials say the testimony tries to fill gaps in the documentation of the killings contained in court proceedings, newspaper reports and Aboriginal records. Curator Genevieve Greaves says the exhibition contains valuable historical information.
We're going quite deeply into 6 narratives that include massacre, they include resistance, they include the native police who were used against Aboriginal people in Victoria and other parts of the country. And we're really doing that through first-person voice. So we're just talking to people connected to those spaces. And so we've got what's on the historical record, but also what's contained in memory as well, in Indigenous memory and indeed in non-Indigenous memory as well.
Grieve says this is the first time a new permanent exhibition exhibition at an Australian museum has detailed the stories of the massacres from an Indigenous perspective. According to the University of Newcastle in New South Wales, about 1,200 Indigenous people in Victoria State were murdered in 40 massacres from the 1830s to the 1850s. Academics say that armed white settlers or farmers would ambush Aboriginal camps in the night or early morning. In July, an online map marking the massacres of Aboriginal clans across Australia's colonial frontier was launched. It detailed more than 150 sites where violent attacks against Indigenous groups took place in eastern Australia following the arrival of European settlers in the late 1700s. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia. This news alert from VOA Asia, the pace of change toward digital banking in Asia is faster than elsewhere in the world, and concerns that Hong Kong would be left behind are starting to fade. That's the latest assessment of the digital banking chief at HSBC, who points to a series of new banking initiatives in Hong Kong. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for great stories and features. This is VOA. VOA Asia continues. Despite 70 years of tense relations between India and Pakistan, the two countries share a passion for each other's movies, food, and fashion trends. Take the example of palazzos, a popular Pakistani type of pants that are all the rage in India. VOA Urdu reporter Ritul Joshi is in Delhi, where she finds the trend began after a new Indian TV channel started broadcasting Pakistani dramas.
There's something about this outfit that fascinates Indian fashionistas. These loose pants were known to only a few 3 years ago. Renowned Indian filmmaker and fashion designer Muzaffar Ali says, in fact, it is a purely Indian outfit.
I have seen people wearing this all my life, especially in the Lucknow and Awadh areas. It was worn by both men and women.
It used to be called izar, very stylish and trendy. It was made with lace and embroidery. Young Rekha in Muzaffar's film Umrao Jaan is also seen wearing the loose white pants.
The introduction of palazzos may date back now, but an Indian woman always teamed her kurta with either a churidar or a salwar, until palazzos from across the border showed up. Palazzos became extremely popular in India in 2014. When a private entertainment channel started airing Pakistani serials. In 2016, these serials were taken off air when relations between India and Pakistan became sour. But by then, palazzos had already made a place in women's hearts and closets.
Pakistani serials had hit off really well with the Indian audience. Their actresses were so beautiful, everyone wanted to look like them.
Inspiration may have come from across the border, but palazzos have now been woven into the Indian fabric. They have caught the fancy of new and young designers.
Be it a short kurti, be it a long kurti, I love to pair them with palazzos, heavy palazzos, printed palazzos. I try to put in all kind of palazzos.
They can go with top, with kurtis and with the suit also.
Office going ladies are also asking for them these days. And we already have them in every color and print. Gujarati bandes.
You never know about fashion. At any time it can change its course. But in India for the moment, it seems these stylish yet comfortable pieces of clothing are what everyone wants to wear. Ritul Joshi, VOA News, Delhi.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We'd like to say hello to everyone listening in Tainan, Taiwan, via the voice of Chung Rung, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chung Rung Christian University. That, of course, is in Tainan, Taiwan. Thanks to everyone there who is tuned in. And no matter where you are in the world, we'd like to invite you to also get our programs from iTunes and SoundCloud. If for some reason you've missed part of our program, you can get them in their entirety online. You can also find us on VOA Asia Facebook each day, where we stream our program. And voaasia@voanews.com is our email address. Contact us when you can. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer John Ellison, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Byrd on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day.